Today is February 22nd, 2008. My name is Gary Landeck. I'm the director of the American Alpine Club Library, and we are in the library at the American Mountaineering Center in Golden, Colorado. And today I'm joined by Bob Ader, who is a library volunteer, and a friend of Dee Molinar, who is with us as well, and Dee's nephew Brad Molinar is with us. And today, Bob and Brad are going to talk to Dee about the 1953 K2 expedition, which one of the events, one of the most famous events in mountaineering history, an incident called the Belay. And Bob and Brad are going to talk to Dee about that a little bit. And Bob, would you like to start, or Dee, would you like to?
So if you could just tell us in your own words, you know, what your story is of the fall, that would be great.
You want to hear about the accident, I
presume?
Yeah, I'd like to describe the accident, which over the years has had many different versions as to how everything happened. But the way I recall it was that on the 10th of August, after an earlier attempt to bring him down on the 7th of August, Art Gilkey's, because of his blood clots in his legs. Finally, on the 10th of August, we started down with Art. Pete Schoening and I went ahead just kind of scout the route down the ridge and to take in some of the fixed ropes on the ice slope that we'd put in for the climb. So after we'd taken down the fixed ropes, Pete and I returned up the slope. In the meantime, the rest of the party had lowered Art down this ice gully, being anchored from above, with Bob Craig kind of guiding Art's down. He was wrapped up in a tent and a sleeping bag while being anchored above by the rest of the party. But they got Art down over a little rock band and then directly onto the ice slope. And that's when Pete went up to the top of the little rock band and got himself a secure anchoring position. He found a boulder embedded in the ice. He put his axe facing uphill. He put his axe above the boulder and had the rope going around the axe and then around his waist as he was facing uphill. And with his ice axe holding the axe into position, his left hand holding the axe into position, his right hand kind of taking the rope in and feeding it out as we lowered Art down the slope. And I remember Bob Bates and Charlie Houston had one rope tied to Art Gilkey and pulling him across the slope, and I had another rope across the slope just below them, and Tony Strother, who was tied to George Bell, came down and was assisting me pull in the rope. So there's actually two ropes pulling Art across the slope. Meanwhile, Bob Craig was while Art was being lowered down the gully, a small avalanche engulfed him and really tired Craig. So I belayed him over to the site for Camp 7, and he went over there to rest and then start chopping out tent platforms. We figured we would not be getting any lower that day, even though we thought we were going to get down to Camp 6. So Bob Craig was unroped and chopping out tent platforms. But meanwhile, Tony Strother, standing next to me, was tied to George Bell, who was descending toward Art from the ice ledge, the rock ledge. And that's when I noticed it. Suddenly Bell, whose feet were badly frostbitten, lost his footing. He shot down the slope, and I remember seeing him go past Art Gilkey. He was beyond Art. He didn't hit anybody. But first thing I yelled, I said, "God damn, there goes George," either out of surprise or the warning. And just about the time I got that out of mouth, I was yanked off the slope and went head first on my stomach down the slope and into the rocks below. And I think the rope between George Bell and Tony Strother doubled across the other two ropes and then took us off down the slope in a big pendulum swing below Art Gilkey, who was still anchored by Pete Schoening. And George Bell, in the meantime, fell farther down the mountain into a rock gully where he lost his pack and his glasses and his ice axe. But soon then, Bob Bates landed on top of me, and we got to our feet and looked around, and Charlie Houston was leaning into the rocks about 15 or 20 feet below us, and Tony Strother was still on the ice slope with the rope kind of doubling around and holding him on the ice slope. But Bob Bates immediately shouted down to Charlie to get up. If he ever wanted to see his wife and children again, he'd have to climb up there real quick. So Charlie responded and came up, and we ended up working our way together up to the site of Camp 7. And that's where we then put in two tents and four of us in one of them. And meanwhile, Art had been anchored to the ice slope so Pete Schoening could come down from his anchoring position, which he'd held for more than an hour with that cold air going into his lungs. I remember his yelling for us to get our weight off the rope so he could, he didn't know how long he was going to hold that spot. So after we got off to our feet and started climbing back up, Pete came down. And then meanwhile, Bob Craig and Tony Strother went over and anchored Art to the ice slope with the idea that we'd come back later and either keep him there for the evening or come back and bring him after we recovered a little bit from our fall. But a few minutes later, they went back. The rest of us were in the tents and came back in just a few minutes and saying the slope was bare, that Art Gilkey had been taken away by an avalanche from above, and the slope was bare. And that's the key point that probably saved us from any further. From there on down, it would have been much more difficult bringing Art off the mountain. And Art, according to Charlie Houston, was pretty close to death at the time. The blood clot had gone from one leg to the other leg into his lungs, and he was coughing continuously. So it was a matter of just a minute or so before he would have been gone in any case. But in a sense, this tragic loss of Art allowed the rest of us to somehow work our way down the mountain. Took us 5 days to get back to the base of the mountain and over to base camp.
You guys were kind of a battered and bruised group. Do you remember what the injuries were?
Well, Charlie had a slight concussion. A few days later, he says he doesn't remember much before and immediately after the accident. I had a cut in my thigh, which I didn't discover until several days later, just about an inch long, but it wasn't bleeding. My blood was too thick, I guess. And nobody else was really injured. George Bell lost his pack and lost his glasses. He relied quite a bit on his glasses. But fortunately, the next day as we started down, one of the first things we noticed was a tangle of ropes and sleeping bags and a trail of blood going down the slope, indicating that Art came to a rapid end. His body was thrown out and down the mountain. And we found George Bell's ice axe somehow ended up doing a flip and sticking into the slope. And a day or two later, we found his glasses, an extra pair of glasses that he carried. So he was so glad to finally be able to see where he was going on the way down the mountain. But meanwhile, the route that we had fixed with fixed rope was now, much of it was embedded in ice from the recent storms. So we had to work very carefully and cautiously down all the way down from one camp to the other.
One question I had for you is that I'm sure you've seen the ice axe that's Pete's ice axe that's mounted in the museum, the Bradford Washburn Mountaineering Museum, right next door to us here. And I was wondering what if seeing that axe today, if that affects you personally in any way, or just your memory, your memories of that, the events of that day, how that affects you today. Yes.
I'm glad to be alive. But I remember after we got back to base camp, we rested there for a couple of days before we headed back down the glacier with George Bell being carried on a makeup stretcher most of the way until we got to some tickly spots where some of the porters, one in particular, insisted on carrying him on his back all the way. But I remember we got to the base mount around the 15th or 16th. The accident happened on the 10th. And on about the 17th, we started for home. I remember on the 19th, according to my diary, I did a little watercolor of the accident, showing how we were positioned on the slope. And I had everyone check it, and they agreed pretty much that that's the way it was. But that's the last I ever saw that watercolor. And as we went our separate ways, everyone was giving different lectures and little different memories of some of the accident on the mount. In fact, Tony Struthers says he doesn't remember pulling in the rope for me down there. I remember him distinctly. He'd taken it in while I brought it in around my ice axe. But frankly, I don't think any slip. My axe was just sticking, the tip was just sticking into the ice. I don't think it would have held very much. And so it was just Pete Schoening's strong anchor and sticking it out throughout the fall without giving up and keeping his alertness and hanging in there that saved all of us from falling any farther.
Dee, can you tell us a little about the first time you saw that ice axe and your encounter at that time with Pete?
Now, Pete Schoening's ice axe, in fact, I met Pete Schoening and his ice axe at the same time back in about 1951 or 2 when I was a park ranger up at Paradise, Mount Rainier, and he came up with a party to climb the mountain, and those are the days when the rangers were supposed to check out all the climbers as to their experience and having proper equipment and clothing and food. And I noticed Pete's ice axe had a very worn down tip. It seemed like a ball bearing stuck into the end of the wood. And I don't know how it got worn down that much, because I've got an axe probably as old as that still has pretty much of a tip on it. But years later, Pete says, "Well, that's the axe that saved our life." I said, "No, we all had our own axe. I mean, we all had expedition axes." And he said, "No, he took his axe along, and that's the one that saved our life. So don't do any screaming about that axe." So that axe had quite a history. And fortunately, Pete gave it to the Mountaineers for their plans to make a museum, but which never materialized. So they ended up turning out over all their stuff to the Washington State History Museum. And it took quite a bit of doing to get them to finally release the axe, at least on a loan basis, to this display here in Golden, American Alpine Club. So that axe has been places, and it'll probably end up back in Tacoma at the Washington State History Museum.
Thanks, Dee. One question I had for each of you, and Bob and Dee, of course, I know you're both climbers. Brad, I don't know if you are a climber or not.
A few 14ers.
Okay. Well, I was wondering if I could just pass the microphone around to each of you and just tell us a little bit about what climbing or the mountains have meant to you in your lives. Anything about it at all, whether it's the relationships that you've made or anything that's, because I know for two of you, that's been a really significant part of your lives, and I was just wondering if you could
tell a little about his achieving one of the 8,000 meter peaks.
How about that, Bob?
Well, first of all, the mountains, I guess, what they've given me is you know, there's a little piece of adventure every time you go out, and I think that's the most attractive thing to me about climbing and mountaineering is just a little bit of the unknown, and you know, you don't have to look at a map and get everything planned out in every detail, and just a little bit of discovering and adventure, that's, for me, that's what it's all about anyway. But, you know, I keep looking back to the K2 team, and 1953 was one of the first books I've ever read, and it's one of the books that got me started on climbing and mountaineering, and it's how we tried to pattern our team in 1997 when we climbed Gasherbrum 2. We tried to keep it a real team and tried to keep a real team atmosphere, and it was inspired by the 53 team on K2. So your climb, D, in 1953 inspired us to have a really close-knit group who still everybody's very good friends. We were very good friends on the expedition. We still are, and a large part is the inspiration you guys gave us back then from, you know, your climb. So we certainly appreciated that.
Charlie Houston recently sent me a letter. He's legally blind now, so he does everything by dictation. But he sent a letter to Tony Struther and me asking how our lives would have changed if we'd actually climbed K2 and did it before the Americans climbed Everest. And my reaction was, you know, I probably would not have been in the summit team, but I would have still been real thrilled to be part of the group effort of this group of guys. I was just really some of the best friends I've had through all the years. We had many reunions, always having a lot of fun with our wives and relating the years, what we've done since. But most of my activities in the mountains in recent years have been just in my basement studio doing watercolors of mountains. So I'm and hiking the trails a little bit with grandchildren. I don't really aspire to anything at the age of almost 90 of doing anything ambitious.
Well, this is Brad Molinar, and I was born in 1954. I lived in Seattle from that time until 58, but I remember being in Seattle and being at the George Center's backyard waiting for Dee and George Center, my father, maybe Willie Unsell, coming back from Rainier. And they arrived, and they were just like eating all this watermelon and drinking beers, and it was like a big festival. It was really, and I was a little four-year-old, and I was kind of inspired by that. And I remember one time about that time saying, I want to go climb the mountain too. You know, you're too young, you know. But I was brought up with all that, and so that was something I've been fortunate. And to me, it's it began a lot with long hikes and just beautiful vistas and, you know, lots of camping and just being away from the city. It's a big break from the urban life, and it's all one thing for me. And, you know, I've bagged a few 14ers, and there's different ways of thinking about it. But the basic thing to me is the wilderness and the wildness of the mountain and the uncertainty and the challenge and the comradeship you develop when you're on that mountain, especially. That challenge is met with a concerted effort and cooperation, and that is a beautiful thing, and it's not something you can always plan. And some of these expeditions, the best ones are the ones with the comradeship that is the basic knot that ties everybody together. And I'm glad to really have been able to observe that from a little distance, but it's the inspiring thing to me, and I'm fortunate. Thank you.
Wanted to add, Gary, I did, Pete and I and a guy named Don Wildy hiked up Mount Elbert one year, and at the summit somebody recognized the name Pete Schoening, and Pete was able to tell a story about the belay and some of the ice axe with questions, and believe it or not, I had a video camera with me, and Pete didn't like to be filmed, so you couldn't film him, so I had to set the camera on my knee and kind of point it at him. And I did get him, and I did get the story, so I'll give American Alpine Club a copy of the story that Pete told on the summit of Mount Elbert, the highest mountain in Colorado.
That would be fantastic.
So,
oh, I didn't know you had that, Bob.
Well, Dee, Brad, and Bob, thank you for talking with us today.